first step that I had when I had children was understanding there's more than five.
There's more than five.
Okay. What does a sensory profile look like? What does that mean?
I'm better equipped to understand my child and why something might be challenging.
Well, I think all the parents on here are like, ooh,
yeah, you got one of those.
Man, you know, I'm a mother, I have two kids. Like, we all have those moments. We all have those, you know.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Sensory Play Reimagined, a podcast exploring how sensory play can help unlock your child's development and well-being potential. I'm your host, Rachel Rothman. I'm a toy expert and mom of three. Today, we're diving into a fascinating topic that plays a crucial role in every child's development: sensory processing and its connection to play. Many of us may have heard of the term sensory play before, but what exactly does it mean? Why is it important? And how can we incorporate it into our children's routines for optimal growth? To help us navigate the world of sensory, I'm thrilled to welcome Becky Lewin, a fantastic occupational therapist who has a wealth of knowledge all about sensory processing and its magic in play. Becky, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's so great to have you. I was hoping just really quickly you can tell everybody who you are and what you do before we dive in.
Yes. So I'm an occupational therapist. I've been practicing since 2010. I specialize in pediatrics, so I play with kids all day, every day. I love to talk about sensory processing and toys and development. And so I'm excited to dive in and answer questions and clear up any misconceptions and, you know, just have a good conversation.
That sounds fantastic. And we will dive more into what exactly is occupational therapy, because I think people even have misconceptions just around that. But for the time being, suffice to say to everyone, I know Becky is an expert within this domain, and I am thrilled to have her here. And I have already learned such a wealth of information, and it has been so helpful for me to better understand my own children and how I could better equip myself for how I'm interacting with them and supporting them. And it's really kind of been like unlocking something that I didn't know I was missing, but through a lens that's been really, really helpful. So thank you for that. And my hope is that we can share that with other people, because everybody deserves to have kind of that aha moment that I had when I was able to better understand my children through this lens. So maybe we can start off with just, what is sensory play? What exactly does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And there really isn't a simple answer, because I think it's actually important to kind of start even a little bit further back and understand that everything is sensory, right? There isn't an experience we have in our day that is not based in our ability to understand sensory information. So if we think about our day, we're constantly assessing sensory information and making sense of it and trying to understand it. And our brain and our body are trying to decide, do I need to pay attention to this? Do I want to pay attention to this? Is this good sensory information that makes me feel good? Is this sensory information that makes me feel bad? And this plays out every second of every day in everyone's life. So then when we think about sensory, if we sort of just accept that, right, that we're constantly using sensory information to understand who we are, where we are, what we're doing, what we like, what we don't like, we can all sort of agree on that. And then if we start to think about sensory play, I sort of think about it as, you know, when I'm playing with a child, how am I thinking about their sensory system to optimize our time together or to help them engage in a play, in the play in a way that feels richer, more involved, more related, more engaged, where I'm getting kind of like almost a bigger bang for my buck from the play.
Yeah.
And by thinking about a child's sensory systems and their sensory profile, we can make play that much more powerful. But just to sort of, again, get on the same page, all play is sensory based, because all interactions and all engagement have sensory underpinnings that let us literally take in the experiences.
Right. That's literally how you're taking it in. I think maybe
it's like literally, yeah.
I was going to say, if we could take a step back, and I think most people are familiar with five senses. We grew up learning about five senses. And I think for me, even the first step that I had when I had children was understanding there's more than five.
There's more than five.
So maybe let's like talk about the five really quickly. We all know what those are. And then maybe we can talk about those other ones that are less spoken about and what they do and how they interact with things.
Absolutely. It's super important. And I'm really glad you brought that up. So we do have the five senses that we all know about. We all learn in elementary school. Taste, smell, touch, sight, and hearing. And sometimes we think about those as the sensory systems that give us information about the outside world, right? They let us make sense of things that are coming from outside and help them make sense of what we're hearing, what we're seeing, what we're smelling, what we're tasting, but things that are happening outside of our body. Then we had three other senses that give us information coming from inside our body. And those are our proprioceptive, vestibular, and interoceptive systems. So,
and now I'm going to make you break that down in layman's
terms. Yes, please do. I insist that you break them down.
Yeah.
So let's break them down. So our proprioceptive system gives us information from our muscles, ligaments, and joints about where is my body, right? So I know where my body parts are in relationship to each other. I know where my feet are as I walk without having to look at them, not because I can see where my feet are, but because I can feel where my feet are. I know, I feel that. And that information, again, comes from our muscles, ligaments, and joints and lets us know where is my body, right? Where are these parts and how are they moving? So that's proprioception. Our vestibular system gives us our sense of balance and equilibrium. It lets us know when where our head is in space. So it lets me know when I'm upside down. It lets me know when I'm spinning. It lets me know when I'm falling, right? Think about how crucial that is. I have to be able to feel myself falling through space to know that I have to
put your hand,
protect myself, right? So our vestibular system, it's our sense of balance and equilibrium and where is my head? And also my sense of like speed through space. So how fast am I accelerating? How quickly am I going? So that's our vestibular system. And then we have our interoceptive system. And that's information that we get from inside our body, from our internal organs, about how am I feeling? How am I, do I have to go to the bathroom, right? Is my bladder full or empty? Am I hungry or thirsty? Do I feel like maybe I'm getting sick or something doesn't feel right inside? So it gives us really important information about our internal state of how we're feeling physiologically, but also research is letting us know that it gives us really important information about how we're feeling emotionally. So it's that feeling of my heart is racing, that's letting me know I feel nervous or I feel really, really excited about something. And that sort of that like maybe giddiness feeling a child might get sort of when they get a little bit like jumpy or bouncy. It's letting us connect those internal feelings with an emotional state.
It's kind of like just internal attunement to yourself.
Yeah.
Going on and understanding it. Okay.
Absolutely. So again, so that interoceptive system is giving us some very like basic body-based information. I got to go to the bathroom. I feel hungry. I feel tired. I don't feel good. And it's giving us some, giving us emotional information about how do I feel on the inside? So then I can use that information.
So it's interesting, like as you're saying it, what gets brought up to me, I have three children, four and seven, and they all receive information very differently. You know, I've been aware of it. And they also kind of seek out different things. Can you speak a little bit to like, you know, there's certain kids who maybe crave a little bit more in some domains, mm-hmm. or they feel a little bit more reticent to wanna, you know, dive into. I think of like, even I'm learning about myself through the children, lens of my children. I don't think people touch me. Like from a perspective, like I'm very sensitive. I'm also auditorily very sensitive. And, you know, now I can see that, but I may not have been aware of that or, you know, attuned to that as when I was growing up. So do you mind speaking a little bit to how like the manifestation of what it looks like in a person, you know, and
absolutely.
You mentioned the word profile before, if we can kind of talk to what does a sensory profile look like? What does that mean through the lens of a child?
Yeah. So I think that's a great question. And I think that it's so important that if you listen to this podcast and you don't walk away with anything else, I think it's so important to realize, to walk away with that, the idea that every single person has their own sensory profile. And that's, we don't need to pathologize that. We don't need to, you know, feel badly about that. It's not in it of itself a problem. It just sort of is. So Rachel, to your point, we all have our sensory preferences, right? We all have the things that we gravitate towards. We all have the things that we don't like as much. And it's the reason why we have such beautiful diversity in this world. It's why we have people that want to, you know, become professional skydivers. And it's why we have people who want to work in libraries. And it's why we have people who, you know, do the different things that they do. And it dictates so much of the choices we make in our life, from the foods we eat, the clothes we wear, the jobs we might pursue, the relationships we seek out, the hobbies. It's so impactful. And I think that's something as grownups, we can really think about, you know, what is my profile? What are the things that make me feel grounded and connected and glued and really in my body and feel really good? And then what are those experiences where I don't feel that way? I feel maybe on edge, or I feel anxious, or something doesn't feel right in my body. And my instinct is like, this doesn't feel good to me. So children are no different. And every child, like you said, will have a different sensory profile. So what we're really looking at there and talking about there is a child or an adult's different sort of threshold or ability to take in certain amounts of sensory stimulation and experience and input and make sense of that. And that's sort of different for everyone. So you might have a kiddo that, you know, wants a lot of movement experience. They're seeking out that proprioceptive, that vestibular.
I'm one of those. I think all the parents on here are like,
yeah, you got one of those. Yeah, you got one, you know it. But then at the same time, you might also have a kiddo who, you know, is much more into like sedentary play. And, you know, that's your kid who's much more comfortable like sitting maybe at a table and chair, or, you know, cuddling up with a book, or maybe doing something that's more sort of on the ground and seated. And maybe when they go to the playground, they aren't quite sure like what they want to climb on, or they might not know. They might not be the first to jump to the top of something or join the gross motor game. That might be a totally different type of profile. And again, I think it's really important not to start from a place of pathology, right? Like, it just starts a conversation around, oh, well, that's, I'm curious about that. I want to understand more. And then I want to make sure that when I'm asking my child to participate in something that might be, say, sort of in conflict with their sensory profile, I want to understand, you know, what I'm asking of that child. I want to have an appreciation for how hard that might be. And it's not to walk on eggshells around kids. It's not to tiptoe. It's not to, you know,
to understand. And,
but it's to understand.
Support and to support appropriately. I think like the way that I viewed it, once I understood it kind of more concretely in the way that you're describing it, it was like a blueprint to my child. And it became so beautiful to just understand it through the way that they may be receiving information. To your point, like everyone is different, and you know, like it's like a snowflake or a fingerprint or whatever it might be, like no two match up perfectly. So even, you know, I have kids who have kind of different thresholds and appreciation for different sensory inputs and stuff, and it also ranges across the different sensory modalities, like you were talking, you know, touch and smell and sound. And, you know, they might be seeking in one domain and they might be a little bit more averse in another one. So to me, it was just like, I'm better equipped to understand my child and why something might be challenging, or why something might be a thing that they're craving, you know, that my daughter who loves, you know, proprioceptive input and vestibular input, and like, she's craving that, like her body needs that for her to feel more at like homeostasis.
Right.
And so like for her, we've actually, with a better understanding of it, have been able to implement different kind of like routines or activities and kind of things through understanding that better, so that the next time she doesn't feel like I need to go run and crash, you know, into my brother or whatever it might be, you know. So it's actually also been helpful just like in relational dynamics for my kids. involved in
right.
Helping get them into a really good rhythm. And it's through that understanding of who they are, how they're walking through space, how they're feeling about things while they're walking through space, and kind of making adjustments to help them feel better about it. You know, like, we're the grown-ups, we understand all this. They may be able to, as they get older, verbalize it, but mm-hmm. the lens of understanding that, how can we make, like you said, like, you're, it's not pathologizing it, but it's just an understanding that can help you to set up different things or different routines mm-hmm. or anything. So maybe,
yeah,
I was just going to say, maybe we can touch upon that a little bit, like how making potentially some modifications to how the routine is set. You know, we all know there's certain times during the day that are just challenging, you know, for
yes.
for some people, it might be yeah. bath time. It might be sure. bedtime. It might be meal time. Do you mind walking us through maybe even like an example or something like that, whereby understanding a child's sensory profile can help make the routine for that or the structure for that or how you're interacting with them easier or more approachable for them?
Yeah. So I think, you know, absolutely. I'm a mother. I have two kids. Like we all have those moments. We all have those, you know, activities that we sort of have to, you know, the sort of have to's of your day. We have to get through this. We occasionally have to bath, to take a bath. Occasionally we have to do.
We're going to have to.
We're going to have to. Yeah. Yeah. Like, there's only so far we can push that off. So
yeah.
I absolutely think it's so helpful to have an understanding of your child's sensory profile so that you can then sort of set yourself up for greater success. Will it be perfect? Like, probably yeah. not. Nothing is. Like, yeah. you know, like, let's just be realistic about that and honest. But we can certainly take something, you know, I kind of think about it like kind of taking the edge off or like the extremes out of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, as an occupational therapist, this is sort of what we do day in and day out is thinking about, okay, what is the activity? What are the components of that activity? And how do we make this more tolerable, more acceptable, and dare I say, perhaps maybe enjoyable for the child if we're so lucky? But oh my gosh, so many examples come to mind. I think, you know, let's go. We were talking about taking a bath and bathing. You know, I think about a family that I worked with where bathing was, you know, a real battleground. And it was just a really, really stressful time. And, you know, I also think you have to, it's not just the sensory information. It's also thinking about context. And, you know, if we think about bath, it comes at the end of the day. You might be getting ready for bed. There could be all sorts of feelings about going to bed. Maybe the child doesn't want to go to bed. Like, nothing happens in
isolation.
I think that's also really important. So let's say we're getting ready for bath and, you know, this particular child didn't enjoy bath time. And we were trying to problem solve, okay, well, what could we do to make this more tolerable? And as they were walking through the routine with me from start to finish, it was very apparent that there was a tactile component to what was happening in the bathtub, because the child would get in the bath and then the child would get out of the bath and they didn't like, when they were in the bath, they didn't like the way that felt, and they didn't like then getting out of the bathtub. And then what was really the clincher was like putting their clothes on when they were still kind of wet and sticky.
Yep.
Yeah. We can all like kind of have that feeling. So that was like even further dysregulating for the child. So then we're sort of like, you know, we're kind of layering on the dysregulation at this point. And then the clincher is like, okay, you didn't want to take this bath. Then you did want to put on your pajamas. You have to put on your pajamas. Now you're kind of sticky. And guess what? The kicker is now we're going to put you to bed. Like,
right.
Yuck. Like,
that person's not going to receive bedtime very well.
I've heard that child is not ready to receive bedtime. So we kind of look at this big picture and we can start problem solving. So one of the first things we thought about, like, well, would a shower feel differently? Do we just need to kind of like flip this routine on its
head? Yeah.
We need to like break up this cycle. So would a shower be received differently? We're standing. This family had like a removable shower head so that they could control the water and where it was going. This is sort of like a sidebar, but sensory information is generally best received when the person is controlling the sensory information.
Right.
So once we gave her the shower head to hold on to, she was in control of the input. And once she knows where it's coming and where it's coming from, when it's going to come, her brain actually receives the information differently. It's the reason why you can't tickle yourself. It's the reason why you can comb your own hair and go harder on the knots than anyone else can, and it doesn't hurt. It's the
reason I even think of driving, like, if I'm driving, like, I'm not nauseous.
Exactly. It's the
husband drives and I'm like, oh, I'm gonna throw
up. Like,
I got you, Jesse. But
exactly. So we don't it's the same physiology.
Yeah.
So when we give when we let the child be in charge of that sensory the sensory input, they can better prepare and receive.
It's so interesting that you say that. Like, I always thought it was about the actual control and the independence and the choice. Mm. It's literally how they're receiving the information, because when you know you're making the adjustments, you can, like, everything that you're saying to me, I'm getting it also from the perspective of, like, no, they can receive that information so much differently when they're in control of it and making the adjustments to the temperature, to the flow rate, to the whatever. Yeah. They then know exactly what's happening to it. That's interesting.
You're closing this feedback loop. So instead of just coming at your body, and your body doesn't know when or where you're doing it, and that just really changes the whole dynamic. So for any of your kids that kind of run a little bit more sensitive, a little bit more, you know, I need to be in control of this, hand over that control. That's a really safe way to experiment all types of sensory play that might otherwise feel too intense, too stimulating, too overwhelming.
Right.
But let's go back to our little girl who just got, so we put her in the shower. We gave her a shower head to play with. She also really loved, you know, we worked with some of her strengths, like with crayons that she could use on, like, the shower wall, or bringing in favorite toys. That's like a always a go-to thing to try. And then when she came out of the shower, instead of pajamas, we switched to a nightgown. So that was really, really loose. So it didn't feel so, like, clingy on her body. So again, these were all sort of little tweaks we could make that was shower, you know, was bath time perfect? Like, no. Is it better?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's funny as you say it. I have a child who's sensory averse, and bath time was challenging for a multitude of reasons. And we realized it was just, like, too much input all at the same time. So even, like, we dimmed the lights in the bathroom, and that was, like, that changed things up.
I love that.
And I was just going to say, and afterwards, I didn't even think, like, I think of myself putting on, like, clothes when I'm wet, and I'm like, that's really yucky. She would be so much more sensitive to it at that time. And so we actually just waited. So, like, we gave her a half an hour. We're like, wear your towel. Like, and, you know, when she did it a half an hour later, it was such a different experience putting on her clothes than when we made her put it on at that moment, you know, to do it. So just, like,
I love that.
Yeah. And I think the awareness of, I have a child who's sensory sensitive, you know, and she's more aware of it. Her body is, like, reacting, you know, like, I think you use with threshold, like, her threshold for receiving it is way lower. And
totally.
It's funny.
I love that you brought up that piece too, because I think sometimes with sensory, but I think of, like, what we're doing, which is, like, sensory problem solving, let's call it.
Yep.
And a lot of times we think about adding more, right? Like, we need more things, more toys, more this, more.
Sometimes it's the removal of.
And sometimes taking away is so powerful. So, like, having that in your toolkit of, like, maybe we dim the lights. Maybe I don't talk as much. Maybe we take something out of the bathtub. Maybe there's too much stuff in there. Or, like, right? So playing with both adding sensory information, which can be really helpful, but also experiment with the taking things away can be equally powerful, if not
depending upon who, right, depending on who the child
is. Exactly, depending on who the child
is. You had the opportunity to look through kind of EduShape's portfolio. I know that we talked about all play is good play, all toys can in some way be enriching. Is there a particular toy that really resonates with you, either that you loved as a therapist, else you love?
Oh, such a good question, because there's so many good ones. So, like I said, every toy can be a vehicle for awesomeness and exploration. And if your child is digging on it, like, that's the most important thing. But I will say that I particularly enjoy the balls, the classic sensory balls. I feel like those definitely have a happy home in our office, and they're really, really great, especially for you know, our little kiddos and our preschoolers, that there's just so much possibility, whether we're working on the eye-hand coordination for catching. I love the like textured, because I think that it like adds another component to it in terms of allowing children to kind of grab and grasp the ball and sort of helping them feel more successful. But even just for sensory play, and it's a really, I think, good entryway for kids that are a little bit more, if they're a little bit more sensitive, like it's a really good entry point for exploring something that has a little bit more texture, but that isn't too overwhelming to the system. And on the flip side, for kids that kind of want that texture, like they really can dig on the like the outer layer of the ball that has that different sort of tactile input. Yeah, that spikiness, but like in a good way. So I really, really love those. I'm also a big fan of the...
I'm as you aware, I was going to say when you're about to name the next one, but as it relates to the sensory ball in our house too, like,
yeah,
kids who have very different sensory profiles, and all three of them dig it and dig it in their own way and a different way. So I think that that is a very versatile one that, like, particularly for open-ended child-led play where the child can come in and do whatever they want with it. Sometimes it's throwing, sometimes it's kicking, sometimes my daughter's like literally rubbing herself.
Yeah,
she's just feeling it. One of them loves to rub it on their
face. Yeah,
get that input. So I think the power to be so many different things to so many kids, which is wonderful. And you're like another one, and I interrupted.
I mean, I always love like a classic like block. Like I think that blocks are so classic, and I love playing with them. I think it's great for all sorts of skills, from motor coordination to also just like motor planning, like what is this, what am I building, what is it going to look like, and then having that be like something that for different age levels and different developmental points can jump in and use that across sort of ages. So whether we're just working on stacking and knocking over, right, which is so fun and for one child, or we're sort of ready to think about building a zoo or building a castle. I love toys that give us like I love toys that give us a big bang for their buck, and that they can like kind of meet a child at whatever age they are in development. Because who needs to be constantly buying toys? There's only so much space and so much money. But so I love those kind of toys that, you know, I could play with that with like a 3-year-old that comes in, and then I could play with that with like an 8-year-old that comes in.
I was just it's the funniest thing that you say this. Literally, as I was leaving my children to come here and record this, they were playing with the blocks, and I mean, they've had it since more or less, you know, at, you know, 6 months starting to just touch them, at a year, maybe stack, whatever it might be, the natural progression. And I don't remember even know these things. But my 4-year-old started to build, he was building a school, and then my 6-year-old came in and she was like, but wait, we also knew, but, you know, and then she added to it. So like, and then they created this whole, they had a whole town by the time that I left. And then my 7-year-old came in and she's like, and I'm the mayor. And so like, it was just like the dynamic of all three of them where they're doing the physical and, you know, motor, gross motor, whatever have you. But then it was the communication, and then it was the socialization, and then each of them components. And like, to your point, watching that a year ago was very different. Watching that 2 years ago was very different. Watching that 3 years ago was very different. But
yeah,
Russian and it has something that for 7 years they have played with and enjoyed and found each time they come back to.
I also like that. I like to, especially for kids that sort of are coming to me and have sort of, you know, their families have identified they need some extra support, I like having toys that then they might run into in the classroom or might run into in a play date, so that they can then feel comfortable. A lot of children with sensory processing differences, like novelty and newness and unpredictability, is like their worst nightmare. So if we can revisit a toy like the blocks or a magnet tile or something that I know they might see in other places, that gives them the confidence, and then, you know, and the confidence to then like, oh, I know that toy,
right?
And then so the blocks are classic.
Bringing it back into like the play sphere, I think similarly though, it's the, how do you create this environment that feels like they want to get in on it, that they want to partake in it? You know, like there have been times I think where I've overloaded and I've realized like, okay, let's take a step back. We got to do some removal. And or, you know, for my child who's kind of in the other domain of she needs more. How do you create like an environment that feels conducive for them wanting to engage? Like you talked about when you create this environment that feels better for them, more tolerable for them, more supportive of them, they want to stay in it. They want to engage in it more. You know, we may not have perfect, but maybe we'll have more engagement or more success. Can you speak a little bit to that? Like, you spoke about a few of the things that they can control. Are there other kind of easy things that parents can be doing at home to set the stage in a way that might be more conducive or supportive for their children?
Yeah, totally. I think that when it comes to sensory play and kind of getting back to like, what is sensory play? I think when we really go back to the roots of sensory integration and, you know, where that theory comes from.
I'm going to pause you because I don't think most people know what sensory integration is. Do you mind speaking?
Oh my gosh.
Really quickly? Yeah.
Yes, that is, no, yeah. Good. Thank you for pausing me on that. That is sort of, you know, when occupational therapists who work on sensory processing, much of the research that we're pulling from is from sensory integration theory, which was developed by Jean Ayers, sort of the founder of, you know, this incredible field. And of course, other people doing additional research and sort of carrying on in her legacy of what she started. But so when we're talking about sensory integration, we really are talking about sensory processing, and the two are often used interchangeably. We're talking about how we use our eight sensory systems to take in information and then use that information effectively and to do the things we want to do. So whenever we're talking about sensory integration or sensory processing skills, it's about how do we take in the sensory information and then how do we use that information? Because sensory input generates a motor output or generates an output in some sort, in some fashion. So it's really the resulting, if we want to think of it as behavior or experience that the child has after they've taken in that sensory information. And that's basically what sensory integration is. That theory really did prioritize this idea of a child-led experience and like following a child's lead and being curious about, well, what's speaking to the child here? And I think sometimes when we come to play, there's lots of different ways we can come to play. And I think that when we come to sort of engage in sensory play, if we want to think about it that way, really putting your agenda or your idea of what needs to happen right now, put that kind of, if you can, to the back of your mind a bit. Kind of put that aside, like put that down. This isn't a time where we need to be testing colors or practicing letters or teaching something that we feel maybe has like an academic foundation, or even teaching manners or this is a time where you really just sort of get to indulge and delight in your child and see where they're going with this. And I think that creates like a really exciting space to be in. And that's where I see kids taking their greatest sensory risks. So what I mean by that is that's when I see kids who might be a little bit more sensitive, trying things for the first time. That's where I see kids who might be those kids who are touching everything or trying everything, maybe pull back for the first time and find like illness in their body and like, you know, oh, I'm going to slow myself down because I really want to keep whatever we've got going.
Right. So it's like it's a safety zone for them. It's a place where they feel really safe to experiment.
You know, really, really safe. And it's, that's so, 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 so important. That safety and comfort and security lay the foundation for development and trying something new. So kids that are on edge, stressed out, grown-ups that are on edge, stressed out, it's really hard to try new things from that space. So I think creating that, again, like kids can smell an agenda from a mile away. Like I know that because I play with kids and I know that because I have kids. It's so delightful to put your agenda off to the side for a little bit.
Yeah.
It's really, really fun.
Okay. And now I don't
know where they are.
As I say, I don't want to get prescriptive about it, but is there like a set amount of time you should be doing this? Is there a certain way in which as a parent, like you should be engaging versus letting them have independent play? Like I feel like play, there's just so many different permutations of what it could look like. And obviously age and stage and all these things are different. But what you're describing to me is like indulging with the child, letting them kind of you know, they go to the play kitchen and they're creating their restaurant and, you know, they want to, what, you know, and so you're going back and forth and doing it with them. Is there ever like a time when, one, you should kind of take a back seat and just observe? As a, like, obviously that's still child-led, but
yeah.
What is the interaction like between parent and child? At what point does it kind of change?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it, could we speak a little bit to that? Because, again, as my kids are getting a little bit older, trying to, you know, when they were younger, by all means, like, and, you know, I thankfully had brilliant people like you telling me this, and I saw, as you're describing, these, like, tremendous gains in a place where I let them go into the place they wanted to go and explore and, you know, really dive into. But at what point do you take either a slightly removed spot and or how can you, if you're seeing that they are having a hard time, kind of course correct and bring it back?
Yeah,
of course.
I mean, really important questions of, you know, I think that when we say child-led, we're not, the child is not running the show in that, like, you're still a play partner. You're still right. A person in this relationship, and you have to keep yourself regulated and you have to keep yourself safe. And if you don't enjoy the way a child is maybe engaging with you or playing with you, like, that is absolutely a time to, you know, in a developmentally appropriate way, explain to the child or redirect the child or, you know, how that's not working for you. So I think that comes up a lot when we talk about rough and tumble play, when there are children who want that physicality. And I'm such a huge fan of rough and tumble play. You know, the research is so clear that it's such a great and important way for kids to be playing. But that does not mean that if mom and dad are the play partners, that they're sort of like, you know, that their feelings are irrelevant. The reason why rough and tumble play is so important is because the power it has in teaching consent, reading your play partner's cues, reading the pacing and timing of the other person. Are they enjoying this? Are they not enjoying this? How do I rein it in? How do I ramp it up? Right? That's the power of rough and tumble play.
Which I don't think most people give a lot of, I'll be honest with you, and until I had brilliant people like you kind of instruct me in that, I hadn't realized that. You know, it was just like, oh, my kid wants to be more rough but then, because I know in theory it's good, but I didn't understand all of the dynamics that you just described as like why it's important and why it's helpful.
We could have a whole podcast just on rough and tumble play. It's you get such a bang for your buck when you think about all the layers. I mean, talk about sensory play and engage your sensory systems, and then the problem solving and the social skills. And
the communication,
or practicing how we ride those highs and lows of our arousal level, right? It gets really, really exciting. But if it gets too exciting, the game kind of falls apart. So we're always riding that like edge.
Yeah.
So again, it packs such a huge punch in terms of like from all the skills, no pun intended, I guess. Like, I hope no one's punching, but it has so many skills in there baked in. So I think that, you know, again, going back to this idea of like, how directive are you, or what's your role in terms of how you are finding that balance between child led? And then also like, that doesn't mean your child can lead you into a direction of play that you yourself don't feel comfortable or that
you know isn't appropriate, right?
You know, isn't appropriate or isn't working for you, doesn't feel good to your body. And it's really important to establish those boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
I think independent play is a beautiful thing. It's something that we want to cultivate in our children. I think knowing yourself and knowing as an adult or a caregiver going into the situation, what is my own bandwidth and what do I have time for right now? So
what are my thresholds of comfort?
And what are my, my thresholds of comfort? So absolutely wanting to, you know, it's a great skill to have it, you know, to be able to go play, a child go play by themselves, and you don't have to be on and doing at every moment. That doesn't mean that isn't a good play experience.
Right.
I think it's knowing like, what am I available for right now? Am I trying to multitask and cook dinner and answer emails and fold the laundry? Like, you're probably not going to be available for a really rich, all-consuming play in that moment. And that's okay.
Right.
Like, you don't have to be. And if anything, you're probably going to frustrate yourself and your child if you try to then
do that as well.
Yeah. I think that that's so foundationally important, is recognizing where you are and how you're feeling and what you're able to receive and what you're able to do. Like, I remember how you kind of said, like, throw everything aside and, you know, whatever. So I remember one of my kids, like, loves putting on pretend makeup, putting it on my face, whatever have you. I'm very sensory averse. I did not know much about this. My husband just thought I didn't want him touching me at night. But it's just like, I have sensitivity to how I'm being touched and how I'm getting, you know. So my daughter was putting on makeup and I had to just tell her, I said, you know what? Mommy really doesn't like this. And we got like a separate doll and she could do it on that and whatever have you. But I realized I wasn't being a good play partner because I'm sitting there and I'm rigid and like,
yeah,
my entire body is tensing up and I was getting upset by it. And so I had to be in a place of where I was comfortable too, to be able to support her play and how she wanted to play. And I think it was also helpful for her to hear, like, mommy doesn't like, that doesn't feel good for my body, as opposed to thinking like, oh, adults, everything feels good and whatever have you. It's like, we're all people and we all are responding to the different inputs. Obviously not in that the language we're using, but for them to see, there are certain things that don't feel good for me. And there's certain things that feel really good for me, and kind of having that dialogue so that they know that they're, it's not, I think you said it in the beginning, it's like, it's not good, it's not bad. It's just like, we're all different, and understanding yourself and figuring out like, what feels really good for me? What, like, what my body feels good, and also understanding in other people, it might not be the same thing. And like, I see that as my kids get a little older and they are doing more, you know, collaborative play. There are moments where like their friend doesn't like something that they like, and to have that understanding of themselves and of others is really helpful for them to be able to, like you said, kind of that give and take and those boundaries when they are engaging in play.
It's so helpful. And it also does build the relation, the, it builds in this idea of like resilience in the relationship. So, you know, if we look at, which is sort of separate from sensory processing research, but look at things like attachment theory and infant mental health literacy, knowing that it's not the families that have no disagreements or no miscommunications that, you know, that's not the problem, is communication in the relationship, say like with your daughter and the makeup. It's the lack of repair or coming back and closing that circle that actually is more it's totally okay that we want different things and feel different ways, and it's modeling for the child, how do we negotiate that problem and still our relationship, and we're okay. The relationship is strong. We can still play together. That is the greatest lesson we can teach our children, to then go out and do that, kind of replay that with their play partners in school. And I don't like that. That's okay. I can think flexibly about that. We can find another way. That's all practice and modeling that we're, that we can be doing at home. That I think goes so far, like, and maybe even perhaps even further than saying things like, well, we want to be kind and we want to be nice. Like, that's not, sometimes children don't know what that means.
Giving them the tangibility of what people can respond to it. No, I wholeheartedly agree with that. It's funny, I was just thinking through as we were talking about like the preferences and what people like and whatever have you. I remember I was probably, I don't know, 25 years old, and I found out I was a super taster. I had no idea what this meant, you know, whatever have you. But food, I always liked really bland. I have a sister who's the complete opposite of this domain as me. And she, like, there's no amount of seasoning, of flavor, of like input from from that perspective. That, like, she just wants more, 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 more. And for me, it was always like the blandest was like already too much for me. But I don't think either of us had the language or the understanding of being like, oh, well, like our bodies are literally just like, the way in which I receive taste, so powerful. It is so overwhelming. It is so much
that
it's funny as I see it again through the lens of my children. It's like there's certain foods that might just be like too much from a flavor perspective, from a whatever perspective, and seeing it instead of like, they're not being resistant. They're not trying. It's literally, you know, as long as you try something, and we kind of maintain that. You also said this kind of like the neutrality around it. It's not good. It's not bad. How do you feel when taking this in? So it's the modifications we also make even to like my children's food or something like that. I keep coming back to it, but it's almost like a blueprint, and it's just helpful to understand why they might be saying something, how they might be feeling, you know, to all the things that you were describing. As we come back to the rough and tumble, because again, we should make an entire, you know, episode about this, but can we also speak to like, maybe even like the sequencing of how you do something, or after you have this like very stimulating, very intense, very heavy movement input, all these things going on. Can we talk about how there are also activities that might be complementary to help ground or to help bring, like, I think that was also something that was like revelatory to me, that it was like, but everyone's saying this is good. And then my child wasn't having necessarily like the output that, or the output, like we talk about like the behavior that comes afterwards.
Yeah.
So in terms of like the regulatory piece, you're doing that, it might be good for your child. How, what are, from a sequencing, from a, in ordering, is there something that you can kind of provide to think, they can better understand it?
I think, yeah. So the first thing I'll say is, you know, we all want like a, like the handbook of like, this is what will calm your child. But, you know, parents know their kids best. And the, when my advice would always be like, watch your kid and see, like, I could tell you that deep touch pressure should calm your child, right? Like that should be calming. But at the end of the day, I don't really know if that's going to be calming. And if you know from watching your child best that if I can just get like, I'm thinking of my daughter right now, like a sticker dolly book. She used to be obsessed with these like sticker dolly books.
Yeah.
I knew that was just like an inroad to her like zen place, right? Like there are things we know about our kids, these little like nuggets, these little bits that like no professional can know other than you.
Right.
So I really recommend like looking at your child and observing and seeing like, wow, like they are in their zen place, and remembering that, put that in your memory bank, right?
Right.
When I turn on an audiobook for my son, like he is in like
just the happy
sleep. Just like
the like you see it in the body, you see it in their and everything. Yeah.
I see it in everything, you know? And so really being, trying to notice those moments and remembering that, and those can be some of your go-to like exhale activities for them, you know, as opposed, and it's good to know about what the different sensory systems do. But sometimes I think parents are like, you know, I tried deep touch pressure and it wasn't working. And I was like,
so then it doesn't hurt.
Right.
Exactly. So stop. Don't do it.
Don't do it.
Right.
So that's one thing. In terms of like rough and tumble and setting up activities, it's really all about like the, you know, if you're going to try something like that, you know, it's really all about your availability to help sort of pace and monitor that type of activity. So when I think about, you know, in my work, when we're doing some like real high arousal, real rough and tumble, real movement based work, where like our arousal level can get quite high, like I'm always really monitoring, where are we? Are we going too high? Is it going too fast? And what can I do as the grown up to help pace this without squashing, being like a bummer, right? Being like, you know, like, oh, you're such a bummer. Like you're taking the wind out of my sail, Becky.
Right.
So some of my favorite, you know, tricks or things that I like to do is within the play, I'll have a reason that we have to stop. So I might say something like, oh, you know, this is so fun. Or like if we're sword fighting, I do a lot of sword fighting in my office and at home. But
what are we using as swords? What are your
pool noodles are good.
Okay.
Like something like foam pool noodles are good. They have like foam swords. It can be really fun, but you know, I'll think of a reason why we have to stop. I'll be like, wait a second, like, are you the king or am I the prince or am I the princess? Like, I'll think of a reason we have to stop and take a beat.
Yep.
That's in the play. Like, I'll say,
you're not removing them from the play. You're not telling them no, or it's getting too much, but you as the grown up are modulating for them.
So I might say like, wait a second, like, are we on the same team? Wait, are we fighting against each other?
Right.
I'll like look for clarification. I won't look to, but I'm giving us a reason why we might have to stop. I may also build in something like a safety check where we might be playing and I'll be like, whoa, safety check. Coffee table is super close to us right now. Like, do you see that?
Yeah.
Okay, I see that. Like,
bringing awareness to something.
Yeah, like, should we move to the bedroom? Should we move the coffee table? Like, what are we going to do?
Right.
Okay, let's go. So I'm really trying to build in these reasons to like pump the brakes so it doesn't keep climbing.
Right.
We practice sort of that, like, okay, we're going to bring it down a notch and then we're going to bring it back up and then we're going to bring it back down and we're going to bring it back up.
Yeah.
Well, I think those are really, I find, great ways just to build in the pacing that a child often needs. Often also, if we're going back to the sword play or the rough and tumble and a child hits, comes at me and it feels too hard.
Yep.
In a whisper voice, I might just say, like, I was, show me another way. Like, yep. I'll whisper, that was too hard, but do it again. Just do it.
The whisper is so powerful.
The whisper.
Take the nothing whisper. Else away. Whisper. And the whisper is so-
This is actually what you should take away from this yes. podcast. The whisper is one of your most powerful tools.
I
do not ever underestimate the power of a whisper.
I like literally had a mantra to myself for maybe a full year to remind myself like the power of the whisper. Like I had to say it to myself because there are like, listen, we're parents, we're human. We're going to at times, there are going to be things that are going to set us off. And for me to maintain, like, It almost feels like to them, like it's a game or it's fun, but you know, it kind of takes them out of it too. So
it feels
The whisper feels special and it's powerful.
Me saying the same exact thing, not as a whisper, could have a completely different reaction. And that is sensory, right? Like if we think about our tone of voice, our pacing, that is all sensory information to a child. So when we calm down you know, and there is a time, you know, our voice changes for certain reasons. But whenever I'm giving information to a child, my goal is, how will this best be received?
Right.
How will this best be received? And if that's in a whisper.
Yeah. Let's do it.
To yell. Let's do it. Yeah. I don't care. Like, I don't have to exert my power. Like, I just want them to hear this message that like, this is too hard or this isn't working for me. That's my goal, is to get that message across. So I'm going to do that in the way that best delivers that message and allows the child to receive it. That's my only goal.
It's it's so funny as you say, like it obviously elicits a lot in me. Like one, the reminder to self, like are there going to be moments where we're going to lose it? Of course, we're human, we're people, whatever. And like you said, come back to the repair of it, of talking about it, of explaining why we felt that way and letting them know, you know, kind of bringing it together. So like there's that element, but also if in the moment you do have the capacity before you get kind of out of it to remind yourself, if I deliver this in a different way, I can change the entire course of this evening. Like that can happen too. And I, you know, sometimes as much as internally I want to say something in a certain way or deliver it a certain way, just reminding myself like how they're going to receive it and how beneficial it can be for them and also for myself. And I think that reminder of we can help change that narrative through that, you know, has been real. Like, it's not like they're winning or we're winning. Like that's never the goal of it. But like, how can we both walk away from this feeling better? And sometimes that might be the change.
I also think
hearing it.
I think also if you're in a sensory play that feels really fun, whether it's physical, like whether it's rough and tumble, whether it's messy play.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes adults, we just like abruptly feel done and like we end really quickly and like the child might need like more prep time, right? This is really fun. And you might begin to say like, you can model that like, oh, you know, this is really fun, but I'm I'm thinking about what's going to happen next. Like maybe it's like, you know, this is so much fun, but I'm thinking like, oh yeah, we have a play date we're going to have to get ready for. Okay. Just like throw that out there and then maybe you do another round and then maybe you stop again and you're like, oh, should we do like one more round, two more rounds? Because then we're going to have to go to this play date. Whatever's happening next, the kind of throw that idea out there as opposed to dead stop. Like we got to clean this up.
Where it feels like
it can often feel
disruptive and like without warning and it's not giving them the time to kind of process
it.
You processed it in your brain, but then
and
their brain.
And know that if you're doing something like this that's hard for your kid, you're going to need extra padding. Don't give yourself 5 minutes to get ready for that play date. Give yourself 15 minutes. Nothing ruins a transition more than the feeling of rushing yourself or your time. Rushness is like literally like a stress bomb in your, in whatever
everybody's
you have to do for everybody. So you can take that time element out so you don't feel rushed.
Right.
And I always say like therapy feels so luxurious sometimes because I got nothing but time, really. Like, I don't have to rush anything because, you know, this is why we're here. And so when I try to take that into my own life, when I go home to my kids, like,
yeah,
do I need to pad this for time? Because if I rush this, there are going to be big feelings,
right,
much bigger feelings.
Right. And then it's also not sending them off in a grounded way too. Like when you rush, like you're then starting off the next one, not on like ground and not well footed. Yeah,
absolutely. And then what's so interesting about stress is, so sense differences in sensory processing. If you're experiencing information in a way that doesn't feel good to your body, that is stressful. And then we also know that stress can often exacerbate our differences in sensory processing. So to take your example for, you know, some of the things you've shared, if you're someone who already at a baseline doesn't love to be touched, add stress to it, and your partner comes to give you a hug, it's like, oh my gosh, like, you need to move like so far away from me. It's like so far away from me. Or, you know, so all of those differences in our sensory processing, sort of those places where we might be a little fragile, those go through the roof from the rest. So, you know,
and then it creates that loop. So how can we break it? So like you're saying, buffer in the extra time, help make that transition in whatever capacity is more, you know, better, your child's better able to receive it. So whether you're giving them the choice of this or that, whether they're feeling empowered for the, you know, the way in which they're doing it,
right,
the ways for your child that will be successful for you to make that transition a little bit easier, that you're not stressing everybody out and starting.
And if you do see that stress, know that that's not a reflection. That's like
it's feedback.
It's feedback. It's
right.
Letting you know this was way harder than I thought. This is really hard. This is not a reflection of me as a parent. It's not a reflection of the boundary I've chosen to set.
Right.
This is not a reflection of any of that. This is a reflection of, oh, this was really hard.
Yes.
This is very stressful for my child.
And I think, again, that information can then serve to make modifications for the next time, you know, like, okay, this time didn't go great, but next time we can make those changes to it.
Absolutely.
Do you mind speaking a little bit to, we've talked about kind of different preferences. Are there certain things that you've seen that are kind of, I don't want to call it uniform. Obviously, there are really involved sensory profile things that you can do with professionals like yourself and other professionals. Are there certain, like, I don't want to call it signs or certain things that you see that it could be kind of a cue to a parent of maybe your child's having a more challenging time in this domain, maybe they are more sensitive, you know, like, how do you know at what point it's, we talked about sensory processing integration. How do you know when, like, it's a little bit outside of the bounds of what would be typical and where you might need more support?
Yeah. I get that question.
It's obviously loaded.
I know, it's a really good question. It's like probably the number one question I get when I'm meeting with a new family. So I think of I always ask families, you know, what is it that your child wants to do that you feel like they can't, like something's getting in the way? What are the things they want to do, want to try, want to participate in, but something feels stuck? And or what are the things you need your child to do that feel just so hard? And that's usually a really interesting like place just to start the conversation around, you know, what they're sort of thinking about and what they're curious about and what's feeling hard at home. And then I usually follow up that question with, that's really helpful. What did that thing look like 2 months ago, 4 months ago, 6 months ago, 9 months ago, right? So the beautiful thing about child development is that they're always changing and growing. So if we have a question about
beautiful is one word to describe that.
when we have a question about, you know, development, it should look different over time.
Right.
So if I have a question, and you can fill in the blank with anything,
right?
Attention, fine motor,
yes,
motor, sensory. If that question is there and is the same and doesn't look different than it did 2 months ago, 4 months ago, 6 months ago, 9 months ago,
right,
you might be at a place where an evaluation with an occupational therapist could be helpful, to get some more insight about, well, what is feeling stuck potentially? And I won't say, and what I tell families is an evaluation is just an evaluation.
Right.
A good evaluation should give you
information
about insight, what's working for your child, what they're really good at, what's working really well from them. And also should give you information about things that maybe are feeling a little bit stuck and potential reasons why.
Right.
And then what you choose to do with that is absolutely right. up to you. You could start therapy if that's recommended. You could wait. Never start therapy. Just
right.
get information.
It's information.
Right. Information.
Right. And you can choose what to do with it.
I will say, you know, if you have a trusted pediatrician or teacher, someone you can talk to, but also I will say that, you know, sometimes I've met with parents who feel, you know, did have questions about their child's sensory profile and maybe didn't feel supported by their pediatrician or didn't feel right. supported by their educational team. And I think you know your child best. You know what those questions are.
Right.
If you sort of have like this desire to find out more information or take a deeper dive.
Get more information and take a deeper dive.
Exactly. Exactly.
I think that that's a really good point that like, if you feel like you need more, get more.
Or get more.
And then you can choose what to do with it. You can
exactly.
do something or decide, okay, now I have the information I need and I feel validated or different or better, but there's no harm in getting more information.
There's no harm. And you don't need a pediatrician or your educational team or whoever, or brothers-in-laws or grandparents, right? Like, if you know you want information, go get yourself some more information.
Yeah, I think that that's a beautiful way to think of it. Okay, so I do want to dive into, as it relates to sensory play, and I think we kind of touched upon a lot of these, but I do still feel like there are so many misconceptions related to it. Like we said, all play is sensory play. Yes, 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 yes. I still feel like some people feel like sensory play is only supportive of developing their senses. Can you speak to how sensory play is kind of beneficial more globally and a little bit to that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think at its most basic, sensory, especially when we're talking about, you know, babies, the toddler years, sensory play is so imperative for motor development. The two are so connected. Sensory input allows for the motor output, stimulates the motor output. And we know that motor development is what lays, you know, so much of that lays the foundation for a child's sense of agency in the world. This is what I can do with my body. This is what I can make happen with my body. Motor development is crucial for the beginning of, you know, communication, whether that's being able to, you know, recruit the musculature they need for speech, or whether that's using their their hands and their eyes and their body for gestural communication. So that's just talking about gross motor, fine motor, and language development.
Explain really quickly, like, what's the difference between gross motor and fine motor?
Yeah. So gross motor, we're thinking about movements of like the lower extremity trunk and like upper extremity. So like bigger, larger movements, things like crawling, walking, jumping, throwing, reaching, balance, coordination of your whole body. So any sort of organized sports, playing at the playground, navigating your house, getting up on furniture, getting down off furniture, all gross motor. Fine motor, we're thinking more of the movements of the hand. And actually, there are other fine motor movements, including that kind of fall under the fine motor category, including movements of the tongue. So the fine motor, the sort of more refined movements you need for eating, swallowing, chewing, language production, smaller movements of the hands to pick up small objects, put things together, of course, laying the foundation for drawing and writing, one of the, you know, super important skill for once we get into sort of elementary school age and even a little bit into the preschool years. Those are all falling under fine motor.
I think one of the things previously, like when I first started learning about all this, it was kind of like PT is gross motor and OT is fine motor, but like that's not the whole picture. And that's kind of an oversimplification that I think actually hurts people's understanding. So do you mind, and again, to come full circle to occupational therapy, it's yes, obviously you would be supportive of fine motor skills and development and things like that. But I also think of it as in anytime there's like a function they're trying to do, how do you support them being able to, you know, what are the functions? Mm-hmm. Those are their occupations. And under, you know, do you mind speaking to that a little bit just so for a list that might be more helpful for parents to understand your background and where you're coming from and kind of the whole picture of it?
Yeah. So, I mean, from when we're talking about occupational therapy, we're looking at a child in a really holistic way. And I'm always thinking about what is the question we have and what are all the different ways I can be understanding or finding a possible reason why or hypothesis of why is this happening for the child? What could be the reason they're experiencing the world the way that they are? So when I meet with a child, I'm looking at their fine motor skills. So again, those sort of small movements of the hands, their eye-hand coordinations, their ability to use their eyes and hands together, their gross motor skills. So that's sort of those bigger muscle movements of jumping, running, climbing, sitting posture, right? How are they able to use their body the way they want to move through space? I'm looking at their sensory processing. So looking at all 8 sensory systems and how they are taking in information and how those sensory systems work together.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind, that these systems don't work in isolation from each other. I've once heard it described as like an orchestra, where sometimes like a sensory system might take the lead, but there's the background music is being filled in by those other sensory systems. So they're in constant communication with each other. They're constantly supporting each other. So looking at how those systems are able to talk to each other and communicate with each other. And then also looking at a child's attentional skills. Are they able to kind of sit and attend to something in a time frame that we would expect for a child that age? Looking at their play skills. How are they using toys? What can they do with an object? How many ideas do they have for that object? And what you might expect at a given age. And then, you know, their social emotional skills. So how are they able to regulate themselves? Or often, how are they able to regulate with another grown up? How are they able to help themselves feel better? Or how are they able to soothe? Is that really hard? Is that really tricky? So I'm looking at all these different kind of areas of development to come up with to then bring back to the parents and the families to say, you know, this is what I think your kid is really, really good at. And given your questions, these are the things I think might be part of what is sort of making things feel hard at times.
Mm-hmm.
I think with physical therapists and often in pediatrics, especially in sort of infant and toddlers, and even there's a lot of overlap, right?
So right.
It could sound like, you know, if you do have therapy for your child, it might sound like at times like your speech therapist and your OT and your PT, we're all working on similar things. And that's not a problem. It's often because there's so much overlap in
right.
these different areas of development that we have to be working on them in its totality. Sometimes my sessions might feel more speechy. And sometimes a speech therapist session might feel more OT. It's really about
right.
responding to what the child needs in the moment to bring all that child's abilities to the forefront.
Right.
I will say that if I have a child that's coming to me where we've kind of done a sensory profile or looked at their sensory profile and nothing's really standing out and it's feeling much more sort of like biomechanical or very true to like, you know, that whatever is feeling hard from a motor perspective is feeling biomechanical or very much grounded in like muscle weakness, that I don't feel like there are other underlying sensory processing contributing factors or other contributing factors, I might refer out to a physical therapist. Or the other thing that I think physical therapy really does have very specific training in that OTs generally don't is really gait training, and gait being the way a child is walking. So if there are really specific questions about that, whether it be toe walking or very pronated feet, so that's when they sort of the ankles kind of roll in, very specific questions about walking gait, running gait, sometimes getting a PT's eyes on that can be very helpful.
Becky, I have like 5,000 more things I want to inquire.
I mean,
so I'll have to have you back on. But I wanted to do a quick lightning round where I'm going to ask you a handful of questions, more specifically back into kind of sensory play activities, mm-hmm. things like that. And then we'll have to have you back on in a few
episodes. Too.
All right. So first up, what was your favorite sensory play activity as a child?
So this is a fun fact about me. My mother is an occupational therapist.
I love it. Love it. Love it.
My mom is a pediatric occupational therapist. So I sort of grew up in like sensory playland. Like I knew that there were seven senses then. Now we know we have eight. But
yeah.
So I had a lot of exposure to this idea of sensory play, and I got to go to her sensory gym a lot.
All right, so she's welcome on with us next time too.
Yeah, we'll have like a mother-daughter talk. But so my favorite, something that I think of when I think about that question, something I did a lot as a kid is I would sing a lot. I love to sing. I still love to sing. And I think that singing is such an incredible sensory activity. I think that, you know, it provides incredible deep breathing, you know, from what I've read about it, it provides like this incredible vibration to sort of your inner internal organs as you sing. It's really, really calming and relaxing. I sing a lot when I play with kids. I encourage kids. I love to like.
You got no kids. Singing. We
Oh my gosh.
No singing on this. Are you sure?
Did receive no singing. Oh my gosh.
Can we get a. No,
I will come back if you make me sing. But
it's so.
I love to.
I was just going to say, it's so true. My sensory seeker, like, there is no place she's happier than when she's singing. Like, it's the most. Her body just relaxes. And like, to your point that you were saying, I didn't even think of that as like a sensory activity. So to
I know.
I would never have thought that.
Yeah.
To her, it everything about it. I just see this child who usually has to be like a mile a minute. So before school, like speaking of tough transitions, going to school for the 15, 20 minutes before she goes to school, she's just singing. That's all she's doing. And it's like the best way to help regulate her. So sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but you were, I was just like,
but yeah. I think that exactly it. Like
of that. Yeah.
That's exactly it. Like there's no, I don't know, like, right. Like, yeah, give her deep Dutch pressure or make her do like frog jumps or have her do a wheelbarrow walk. Like, no, like have her sing, like, right. Like
her,
beautiful.
That's
like, that's the thing. So for me, it was singing. I love to sing and I've had it. That would be very relaxing.
It's actually funny. She sings in every language.
Well, that's amazing.
And now she can identify them all. So like, there's a lot of things going on.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah, but I love it. It's so beautiful. All right. If you wish all parents knew one thing about sensory play, what would it be?
About sensory play, you are your best set. You are a sensory tool. You are a vehicle for sensory soothing and regulation and play. And it's so great to have useful toys and toys that like help you kind of spark the fun and the game. But you are your best sensory tool.
That's great. It's funny, as you said that, when you first said it, I was like, is the you the kid or is the you the adult? And I'm like, you both are, but you meant the kid.
But I was like,
it is true because you both, like,
yeah.
But of both of you is providing
in
a beautiful way. What is one sensory activity you recommend for all kids? And maybe not all, but like most. Like, is there one that you're like, that they receive well?
So when I was in grad school and you were learning about all this, it was very overwhelming, right? You're supposed to play with the kid and know the right sensory information to provide. And, you know, how do you know that? And I had a professor say, like, don't worry. When in doubt, probe it out. So I think that So when in doubt, proprioceptive input seems to have, you know, for kids that are feeling a little like upregulated or a little like hot, you know, we want to bring their arousal down. Proprioception seems to be like a pretty
good pathway. Give some examples of that for people who
of like proprioception.
Yeah.
Then for kids that need a little bit of like upregulating or a little like kind of like low and slow, a little lethargic, let's get a pep in your step. Proprioception seems to like bring them up a bit.
Yeah.
So when thinking about that, think about anything that involves pulling, lifting, pushing, anything that uses your muscles and joints and ligaments to engage them in something. So it could be carrying something, it could be pushing something, it could be lifting something, it could be something you need to get in your house. So a lot of times in like in preschool settings or young elementary school settings, that might look like a helper job, right? Like, take advantage of a helper job. Carry this, push in the chairs, scrub a window. Like, my goodness, put those kids to work. It's like such a fun activity and gets that proprioceptive input in. It's sort of like the way I liken it for adults is if you are someone who works out and you're feeling like kind of red, the workout will help you come down. And if you're feeling kind of sluggish, like we sometimes had eye before, it picks you up. So that's the power of proprioception. So I credit my professor.
When in doubt, prop it out. My husband's going to be hearing that ad nauseum now. So it's when you said there was something at some point, somebody had kind of like gifted me with that too, not with the great terminology, but somebody had said that to us. And it was the combination of the let's give them something where they feel like they're being helpful. So like, that agency and that sense of I am a helper, I'm a doer, I am, so that combined with the actual movement. So like we literally will stack up Amazon boxes like outside of our house and we wait for it right before bedtime. And I'm like, oh, I need you to help me move it from here to here. That like literally we don't actually need, I'll be honest with you. But and then like they, I learned of the term heavy work and, so
heavy work. I'm glad you brought that up because you will hear that word. Heavy work is proprioception,
right?
Proprioceptive input.
Right.
Those two words. Yeah.
So for me, it was like it changed nighttime for us. Like I had one daughter who needed to like calm herself, and it provided that for her. And the other one who, again, needed to like ground herself and feel like more rooted in her body before bedtime. So it was the one, it's like you said, it's kind of the one thing that wherever they were at, it helped them come back to a place that felt more balanced, more calm, more regulated, ready to like bring, that state of zen that we were talking about. That's a great one. All right. One more question in this realm. What resources would you suggest for parents who want to learn more about sensory processing, sensory profiles? You mentioned an exam. Are there people to follow besides yourself, but are there resources that you would
suggest? John. Absolutely. There's a lot of resources out there. I really love the STAR Institute. Their facility is out in Colorado. They have so much information on their website. It is a really great place to go and get what I think is very, good information and accurate information. They have little quizzes you can take, and they also have a lot of free webinars and educational videos for parents and caregivers. So I think the STAR Institute is a great place to check out. I love Perfectum. Perfectum is an organization that specializes in a type of therapy called DIR floor time, but they also have tons of webinars and blog posts and information about sensory processing and really thinking about that as part of a child's individual profile or part of their what makes them unique and fantastic and wonderful, and how do we understand that while we're simultaneously trying to support children with things that might feel hard. So again, that was STAR Institute, Perfectum. I have some of my favorite like go-to books that I think are really have really been informative and helpful in terms of my work with children as a therapist, but also as a parent. One that comes to mind is Beyond Behaviors by Mona Delahook. Really was a game changer for me in the way I was thinking. And she has some really wonderful chapters on sensory processing, in particular, that I think are really, really accessible. I will say there's so much good information out there. And if getting information is helpful for you, like that's great. If you're starting to feel overwhelmed by the information, like
step away from the Google.
Turn off your Instagram. Turn off your Instagram. Step away from the Google. That might be a time to meet with a professional if you're like becoming so immersed or so overthinking it. or yeah, like it's a fine line of finding the good information and the right amount of information. And sometimes it just becomes too overwhelming, and that's not helpful either.
Right. Definitely. Well, I just want to say thank you so much. Thank you for sharing all of your expertise, all your thoughts, all the brilliance on sensory play. I know it's been really informative for me personally, and I know it'll be super helpful for others. I think it's always important to remember play. Yes, of course, it's fun, but it's also so essential to a child's development. Like you said, I have never seen more gains in my own children than I have through play. And I think it's just it's this beautiful gift. And people sometimes feel like, oh, it's play, but play is so impactful. It is so beneficial. And I think also recognizing kind of how you shared, sensory play can be so supportive of helping a child regulate, of helping them walk through the world in a more confident, more composed, more regulated way. So thank you for sharing all of that.
Yeah.
And of course, for more information on sensory play activities and resources, check out the links below in the show notes. Becky shared so many amazing things, and we'll be sure to drop it there. And of course, don't forget to like, share, subscribe to this channel. And thank you to our sponsor, EduShape. You can go to their Instagram page. There'll be more insightful conversations on all things toys and child development, and of course, sensory play. So again, a big, big thank you to you, Becky. I'm just so, so grateful and so appreciative. So thank you.
Thank you for having me. This was such a great conversation. And I'm so glad we're having this conversation. It's such an important conversation to be having. So thank you for making this happen.